Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see a few faces in this room. And for those joining online, it really has been my prayer that this is not just an experience in the lead up to Christmas, that's something we do or get around, or a disappointment that we weren't able to gather together, but it is really a time of a powerful connection with God and with hope. So maybe just as you, by way of you getting to know me a little bit, I was watching YouTube a few years ago and really getting down, you know, YouTube allows you to get into a certain theme. And so I'd got into the theme of boats. And that was on one weekend. By the Tuesday, I'd really decided I was going to buy a boat. So the Wednesday, I connected with someone on Gumtree, cheapest boat that was known to Melbourne, and made contact, and we arranged a time that I'd meet him at the end of when he got home from work the next day. Started in the car with my daughter, and we began driving to the suburb indicated, gave him a phone call, said, oh, I haven't got your... I wanted to ask him his address because I hadn't got that yet. He didn't answer the phone. And by that time, we're committed into like a 90-minute drive, and so I just rung every now and then on the trip. We got to the suburb, and he still hadn't replied, and I said to my daughter, what are we going to do now? We don't want to go back home already. My heart is set on this boat that I've been dreaming of for days. And so we said, well, why don't we pray? And so I asked her, which way shall we turn? She goes, right. I did that thing, you know, are you sure? Because straight down this road might seem a bit more sensible, you know. So I think right. So we turn right, and the road curves around, and sure enough, there's the boat that I'd seen on Gumtree in the front driveway. And so we park the car and go down to the door. And as I walk down to the door, I think, hang on a minute, this is weird, because I don't know, he hasn't given me his address yet. So fortunately, I had a 10-year-old daughter there. I've got four kids, and I was able to put her like in front of the door and then knock on it, and I somehow avoided the question, oh, how did you find our address? We weren't expecting you yet. And were you calling? Oh, sorry, I'd left my phone in my bag. But anyway, bought the boat and had a couple of adventures in it. And then we were camping one night. It had been anchored offshore. Woke up the next morning to find this little image awaiting us. And this is one of those moments where a picture tells a thousand words. So the end of my little boating story is this image here of trying to recover hope that was lost. Now, fortunately, there was insurance. The insurers eventually came and claimed that boat. And I've got another one now, which is still floating. I don't know about you, but for me, my lived philosophy of hope is really that Australian sort of approach. She'll be right. Hope for the best. And I would describe that on consideration as a lazy kind of optimism. But what about you? What is your philosophy of hope? I've really enjoyed getting into Isaiah 51 and asking that question of the text. Where is hope? What is the promise of hope found here? Because we're looking with the benefit of being in the future. We're looking back at a text that was written 800 years before the birth of Jesus, a promise of him coming. And this chapter and the chapters around it are a promise not only of a concept, but a person that's fulfilled in the baby Jesus. So we get to look at this hope through a dusty promise that's dusted off with the birth of Jesus, through the lens of seeing Jesus having grown up and fulfilled that promise, and not quite understanding what it would have been like to be in the midst of 800 years of expectation, 800 years of hope. What about you? Would that kind of hope, that length of waiting, do you think that would deepen your hope, or would it erode it? We're in a time in our world right now of waiting for many things, a time when things are less certain than we would like them normally to be, a time where it's not even certain the way that we'd be able to gather to worship on a Sunday, but gather in some way we will. Does that erode your hope? Or do you find a new hope, a deeper hope in response? Got a friend in Cambodia. She's a little bit older than me, and she was alive in 1975. In fact, she was 11 in April when the Khmer Rouge came and changed forever that nation's history. What happened was that the people in the capital city, Phnom Penh, were ushered out of their homes on one day in April the 17th, and they were taken out of the city under the pretense of evacuation. Soldiers went door to door and said, "You must evacuate. We've got intel that there's going to be a bombing." And it was days before, as they were marched out of the city and well beyond its outskirts, that they realized we were had on that one. This was a pretense of being saved, but actually this is us being taken into a great time of suffering. And so as the trip went, Noit headed north and was paired off from parents and was paired off from siblings and found herself in the northwest of Cambodia, where she would live for the next few years under dire circumstances, incredibly isolated and lonely as an 11-year-old. She was given talks in the afternoon as the labor of the day would be broken up. And the lectures went like this: "You no longer have a family. Your family is the organization of the government." They would sleep in these long houses with many people. They'd wake up very early. They'd do excruciating labor, planting rice, digging canals, hauling dirt to make roads. And if you died from exhaustion, that was no concern to the organization who said it was family. Their food was a spoonful of rice a day for 4 years. One cup of rice fed 22 people per day. And so their approach was they'd grind the rice down and then make it into a broth, which would be distributed at night between each of the children. Imagine the horror of this. Imagine the shrinking of hope in that kind of a situation. One day, there's the sound on the road of machinery, the kind that they hadn't heard for years. And so as a 13-year-old would, she rushes out to the side of the road, tries to hide in the bushes, but is as evident as a young person trying to hide in the bushes is. And so the truck rolls up the road. It stops because it's seen a person hiding and asks her to come out. It's the Vietnamese army having just liberated the capital. And the soldier makes this dramatic statement, which forever changes the fabric of Noit's life. It's this. Simple statement: "You're free. You can go home now." So after these years of lack and poverty, after this time of not even having shoes on her feet or much clothing to speak of, in one moment, everything changed, and at the same time, nothing changed. She was not clothed any differently. She was not fed any differently. But the social fabric, the political structure, the authority that would carry that country and the possibility for the future changed in that moment when that statement was given. That story for me is the best encapsulation of what the gospel is for us that I know. An announcement of good news that the fabric of everything has changed, The authority structure in heaven has changed and is coming to earth. The social fabric and the possibility for hope has changed and is coming to earth because of what Jesus has done. That's the big story that sits behind these passages of Isaiah. The big story that sits in Isaiah 51. The backdrop is changing. But maybe you, as you think of this morning, you say, well, I don't even have shoes on. I don't even have any sense of where to start with hope this Advent, except for putting it on a bauble on my tree that I want to smash. Maybe that's you. And you say, where does hope start? Or maybe you're like me and you say, I had a lazy kind of optimism. Hope for the best. She'll be right. But that is no longer sufficient for this time of life and society. Where do I start? I've loved looking into Isaiah and asking the question of Isaiah 51, where does hope lie? Begins in verse 1 like this. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness and who seek the Lord. That pursuit of righteousness is one of the threads that we see right through the Old Testament, right through these passages. If you're like me, you read that word righteousness and you think of that personal pursuit of holiness, which is part of it, but a narrow part. Tim Keller says this. When most modern people see the word righteousness in the Bible, they tend to think in terms of private morality, such as sexual chastity or diligence in prayer and Bible study. But in the Bible, tzedekah refers to day-to-day living in which a person conducts all relationships in family and society with fairness, generosity, and equity. That relationship with one another and the relationship with God. We would call it flourishing relationships. And we would see that quest for righteousness on primary school banners and billboards all over the place. When we see them talking about enrollment, we would see that quest for right relationship with one another, flourishing relationships in words such as, well, flourishing relationships. We see some of that quest all over our city, and this text is speaking to people who pursue relationships like that. It says, if you're seeking a flourishing relationship with others and with God, listen up. Look to the rock from which you were cut, to the quarry from which you were hewn. Look to Abraham, your father, Sarah, who gave you birth. When I called him, he was only one man, and I blessed him and made him many. Even this is counterintuitive to the way I think we normally look for hope. We look for hope in governments or in resourcing or in plans that would set us up with a high chance of success. We look for fail-safe opportunities to put our hope into. And we're surprised when it doesn't happen. I've got a mate who's booked 6 overseas holidays in the last 2 years. Every one of them has been cancelled. I say to him, why do you keep booking them until things settle down a bit? And he keeps getting dashed for hope. And I think went to Phillip Island or something recently, and that's that. But we're so used to putting hope in things that we trusted as certain. And we wonder, why is my hope being dashed? As we look to the future for our hope, and Isaiah 51, the end of verse 1, says, let's begin by looking at the past. And rather than looking at the fabric of a big story, let's look for that little seed. Isn't that the kingdom every time? Jesus described it. He said it's like a tiny little mustard seed that has a plant that grows like a weed and it overtakes the whole garden. And you think, how on earth did that get there and get out of control so quick? That's what the kingdom is like. In this example, the kingdom is like one man. Abraham started with him, but he was blessed and made into many. I invite you this morning as we look at this text and we consider hope to start small. We know the fabric of the story is transformative, and for us in Australia and for all peoples across the globe, the big story that everyone's invited into is that gospel story that says everything has changed. The backdrop is different because Jesus has come. But it does start small. For Noit, it started with a small step towards Phnom Penh. She found a couple of her siblings on the way back, was reunited with her mother, and her life has been one of discovering Jesus, healing from the trauma, and reconnecting with herself, others, and God. But it starts with a small step. No one asked this morning, what about you? Where do you see even a small, microscopic drop of hope? Maybe that's God. Verse 3, the Lord will surely comfort Zion, and he will look with compassion on all her ruins, and he will make her deserts like Eden. Once again, a little bit counterintuitive to the way that we would often consider searching for hope. We look for the future, we look for our plans. We're less inclined to look in places of sadness, of desolation, and of places needing comfort. But in Isaiah 51, we see this is the space to start. I don't know about you, but this year I've needed to learn how to lament. I didn't even know. I didn't even know how to share honestly my sense of hurt and pain to God when things weren't going the way that I expected, because I wanted to praise him only for the good. Different psalms have come alive to me, different stories and different people. A friend of mine down in Hobart, Tasmania, is involved in leading this thing called the Choir of High Hopes. They meet on a Tuesday afternoon. They go to different presentations and performances along with all sorts of different choral groups. And if you were to assess it musically, they would have to be the least excellent out of all the presentations that go on. But if you assess it socially, it makes sense as to why they're the ones that get the standing ovation. They're the ones that have the tears of the audience falling down their eyes. They're the ones that inspire the most hope, because they have come from places needing comfort. They're a bunch of people with additional needs, diverse backgrounds, challenges that they face that most of us don't have to face. And when asked on a little video about what it was that they appreciated about the choir and why it was that they joined, they simply described Tuesday. And how the fact that Tuesday was coming meant that they could get up. And initially, the leaders, like my friend, thought that they meant on Tuesday, it made it easier to get up. But no, members of the Choir of High Hopes found it easier to get up every day, because Tuesday was coming. And that, to me, I heard that story and I thought, that sounds like the gospel. It comes into our places of pain, into our places of isolation, into the places without hope. And yet, often, we try to protect those places in our lives from God, as if he would disapprove of those places that need hope. I look to those stories in Australia and all over the world, and I think I need to be a part of my own choir of high hopes. I was in a thing this week called a symposium. Didn't know what that was, Googled it. Symposium, if you're interested, is one of two things by definition. It's either a drinking party or convivial discussion, especially held in an ancient Greece after a banquet, or it's a conference or meeting to discuss a particular subject. So I went to my Zoom symposium, not quite knowing what to expect. It was the second definition, which isn't that surprising. We had an Indigenous elder as one of the speakers, and he described good theology as this. He said, good theology is about locating where Jesus is. He said, at the moment, in my people, we've got a lot of sorry business going on. There's a bunch of deaths and some very, very, very tragic deaths. And so he said, those words to me, words that I memorized in Sunday school because of the competitive efficiency, Jesus wept, you know, John 11. The fact that Jesus wept at a funeral is of huge encouragement to this Indigenous elder because it says he knows what it's like to be here in these tragic experiences by the graveside. He knows what it's like and he weeps over it. He knows what it is to provide comfort. Good theology is locating where Jesus is and what he's doing. So I ask you today, what about you? Where do you need comfort? As I look through Compassion's church partners, there's 8,000 different churches that we work with in places of extreme poverty for children who are in very vulnerable situations to help them to develop spiritually, physically, socio-emotionally, and economically, holistically, into what God has called them to. As I look at those stories, there's so many stories of unexpected hope coming out of very difficult situations. A visitation that results in the transformation of a life. One child that becomes sponsored in Compassion's work, but who impacts their sibling, who is in no way associated to the actual program, but who then connects to faith as a result, transformed, and is one of the leaders in the Compassion program. Those sort of stories, time and time again, where the least likely thing for God to do or for the place for hope to arise comes from there. Verse 4, listen to me, my people, hear me, my nation. Instruction will go out from me. My justice will become a light to the nations. The second thread, righteousness and justice. And again, I think of, well, to be honest, I think of Judge Judy. When I think of justice, you know, belt of the hammer, a witty remark here, a judging remark there, and that's my image when I read that word, but that gives nothing of the depth or the hopefulness that comes with what Isaiah is saying God promises here. Justice is mishpat. It determines how love is known. Think legislatively. The rules in society that would describe how love will be enacted when things get tough. How the sentence is pronounced and how judgment is executed. The judicial and the executive. How are we going to carry out systems and processes in our society in such a way to enable right relationships, flourishing relationships? And they represent it often with these scales. The right relationships, righteousness, and the systems and processes that give and enable people to have their rights and to be treated with the imago Dei, the image of God that's in them. Those two things are held together. One day we'll only have righteousness because the old things will pass away, the new things will fully come, and right relationships will be easy. But in our current reality, we need both. We need the Tzedek and the Mishpat working together. When right relationships, when flourishing isn't happening for some reason, we need systems, processes, and intervention that would enable that to happen again. This is the promise that's and the themes that are woven around in Isaiah 51 here that talks about not only concepts, but the promise of the coming of a person. Because in verse 5, we get personalized. My righteousness draws near speedily. My salvation, my rescue is on the way, and my arm will bring justice to the nations. There's a personal promise. I'm coming. And I'm the one who enables flourishing relationships. And I'm the one who sets up systems that makes things right, returns them to the way they're originally intended. And both of those things are enabled by my salvation, my rescue, deliverance, salvation, safety, and welfare. The result of this is that the islands will look to me and they will wait for hope from my arm. The one who brings healthy relationships is coming, is the promise. He'll restore things to how they're meant to be, sets up structures that make it that way, and that is worth hoping for. My prayer for this community this Christmas is that you would find hope through flourishing relationships and things being restored to the way that they ought to be, regardless of where it occurs or how small it starts. What about you? Have you located a glimpse of hope in your life yet? Maybe that's the mark of the gospel, the mark of Jesus, his personality of righteousness and justice being expressed in that situation. Don't despise it because it's small. Celebrate it because it's there. We're all learning to reframe our experience in the light of what's happening all over the world right now. There's a whole bunch of applications to this message and this text. Maybe for you, it's receiving the hope of Jesus Christ through a personal relationship with him for the first time. Maybe it's locating that hope in a situation that you've otherwise determined is all despair, but you're saying hope is more than a bauble on a tree, a sign on a supermarket wall. Hope is able to be located in my life, in this big story, this Christmas. Maybe it's to give a seed of hope. So one of the things that compassion does is creates opportunities for ethical giving at Christmas. And I am tipping that all of us, including me, have opportunities to not have to give something that you have, you're obliged to give this Christmas, that you don't want to just buy junk for someone, but you want an ethical option. And so just very briefly this morning, compassion has ethical options for giving. They're called gifts of compassion. And it's possible to buy little cards. Now, I would have had the cards here. In fact, they're in my boot this morning. You can, fortunately, still buy them and digitally access it or request a card to be posted to you. If you're going to do that, you would need to do it today. But that QR code will lead you to the website, which you could otherwise access through compassion.org.au. But I encourage you to think about giving ethically this Christmas, giving to a cause that matters. And personally, I've aligned myself to the cause of supporting vulnerable children through churches that are in the context of extreme poverty in Jesus' name. Then we come to verse 11. Those that the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. It is He who comforts you. This Christmas, whether you're finding, locating, or giving hope, or maybe all of those three things, may it be a Christmas full of that tiny hope expressed as part of that huge story that tells us ultimately everything turns out amazing. God bless you.